Today on Straight Talk Africa, a look at how regional and international institutions contribute to trade in Africa. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Salih, and today we are discussing trade in Africa and the various institutions that shape it. After nearly 4 years of talks, African leaders have launched a continental free trade area. The 3.4 trillion economic bloc aims to boost cross-border trade and usher in a new era of economic development. VOA's Paul Ndiho has more.
The African Continental Free Trade Agreement officially went into force on May 30th, 2019. It was signed in Niger by all but three African countries and establishes the world's largest free trade area since the creation of the World Trade Organization in 1995. The deal will progressively eliminate tariffs among AU member countries. African leaders hope it will be an economic game changer that will unite more than a billion people, boost inter-regional trade, and unlock the continent's enormous economic potential.
African trade today is conducted on U.S. dollars, euro, and increasingly renminbi. What this is doing is to reduce the use of fiat currencies in the bilateral trade settlement in Africa, because we estimate that that costs Africa between $5 to $7 billion. And beyond that, it also reduces the trade.
But the new free trade zone faces a number of challenges. African Development Bank president says that if African nations want to set up trade and economic development on the continent, they must remove non-tariff barriers.
Challenge cannot be solved unless all the barriers come down. Free mobility of labor, free mobility of capital, and free mobility of people.
The bank chief also encouraged African countries to increase trade with one another.
So Africa has to industrialize. Industrialization is critical. It's not just about moving raw materials, it's value-added products.
Tariffs are a major source of revenue for African countries. Nigeria, the continent's largest economy, signed the pact. Abuja had been reluctant because it worries that protectionism could hamper the free trade deal. But the Manufacturers Association of Nigeria says any attempt by the country to slow pedal the implementation of the pact could hamper the free trade zone's effectiveness.
Harmonization of the custom arrangements, particularly not just the custom tariffs, but also non-tariff barriers and technical barriers. I think these are something that have to be negotiated among the participants in the agreement that will try to eliminate the possibility of increased dumping and increased smuggling.
Some are worried Nigeria will be flooded with cheap goods from more competitive neighbors and undermine the country's efforts to revive local manufacturing and expand farming as it tries to reduce dependency on crude oil exports.
It's definitely not a level playing field. And it's to me, I consider Nigeria the lion of Africa. You know, we have the largest population, we have the largest market. So it feels like we're given so much. We're given so much for not enough.
Observers say some countries will benefit more than others. South Africa, the continent's most industrialized economy and arguably the largest exporter, is already conquering much of Africa with its brand of supermarket chains, banks and telecommunications firms. Countries like Ethiopia and Kenya are hoping to tap into the continent's market, investing heavily in railways, highways and power generation projects. Eritrea, the only African nation that hasn't joined the pact, says its government supports the bloc and plans to hold talks with the AU in the near future. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining us here, expected to be two distinguished guests. Joel Kibazo, a former Communications and External Relations Director at Africa Development Bank, and Professor Benedict Okeh Orama, President and Chairman of the Board of Directors at the African Export and Import Bank, is expected to be joining us momentarily. I have to say that, Joel, it is a pleasure, of course, to meet you again.
Thank you.
After having met you recently in London.
Thank you.
And I honestly have to say, as I often do, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity, by the way, to actually host you on Straight Talk Africa for the first time,
Joel. Thank you. That's true. I've been a fan for a long time, so it's a pleasure to be here.
You're most welcome. Well, we'll be joined momentarily by Professor Okeh Orama. Joel, you come here at least, I know, twice a year. Mm-hmm. You come here, for example, during what we call fall.
Yes.
And you call it, of course, across the Atlantic, you call it autumn.
Yes.
And you also come here during spring.
Yes, that's right.
And you, each time you come here, you come to attend these important meetings of the Bretton Woods institutions.
Yeah.
The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund.
Yeah.
How are these meetings very important for Africa?
These meetings are extremely important for Africa, not because they happen to be in Washington, because that's where the two institutions are. But Africa must always be a player on the international stage.
Mm-hmm.
And almost, I think, without fail, all African finance ministers or ministers of economic planning are involved because they are governors of these institutions. So it is important that the African voice is heard on the key issues that affect them and affect the world. So people like me come to support those kind of the officials, but also the private sector that is involved in Africa. So it is important that we are seen not just from the sidelines, but as crucial players on any discussion that is taking place globally.
But Joel, what about the fact that there are a lot of people who complain about the fact that these important Bretton Woods institutions, which were founded following the end of the Second World War, are essentially controlled by almost the same people that control, for example, the United Nations?
Yes, I mean, and I think there is that argument that is put. However, do we extract ourselves as Africans from an international system that governs trade, that governs how everything happens? Or do we say that we are going to be a player and try and get our share of what is rightfully ours? So it is the second argument. The reason we must be at the table is that we need to get what is ours and put our case. And unless we do that, we are going to sort of miss out.
Africa is on the table yet, but you are on the table, but do you in fact have the voice?
I think you do. So for instance, if you take the Development Committee, which is the body, and it's both IMF and the World Bank. It is the Minister of Finance of Ghana that is now chairing that committee. You know, so for the first time in a long time, Africa is chairing. So that means that you can help shape the discussion and the interventions that will be made, and actually bring to the table issues that affect us and are our concern, rather than only those issues that other parts of the world are talking about.
But is that really like telling me that the current president of the United Nations General Assembly happens to be a Nigerian, Ambassador Jibril Bande, and yet you know as well as I do that in fact what controls the United Nations is not the UN General Assembly, but rather it is the, it is, of course, the Security Council of the United States, which, you, as you know, has five permanent members.
Yes.
And Africa happens not to have a single, any single representation on that table.
I fully hear you, and I've taken part in a number of those discussions at the United Nations over the years. I remember in my past career as a diplomat. But what I would say is that in the case of the World Bank and IMF meetings, it is a different setup that enables us to have a voice. For instance, the World Bank is mainly about alleviating poverty. Let's not pretend, let's not ignore the fact that poverty is still a very big part on our continent and in our societies. So to the extent that that is the case, from people like me, it is about getting all those resources to be able to deliver to our people. So I think in the case of this particular set of meetings, we managed to do that as Africa.
You remind me of someone telling me that you go to war with the army that you have,
yes,
rather than the one that you wish you had.
I completely agree.
Very interesting. Well, I would like to welcome Professor Benedict Oke Orama, President and Chairman of the Board of Directors at the Africa Export Import Bank. I have to say, Professor Rama, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa for the first time.
Thank you very much, Zari.
You're most welcome.
Yes.
How was your trip to the Voice of America studios?
It was good.
Good.
Bit of traffic.
Traffic jam, of course.
Considering I just arrived today from Singapore.
From Singapore?
Yes.
But when you talk about traffic jam, I think you are not very much unfamiliar with that, because you happen to live in Cairo the last time I checked.
Yes. So we are used to it.
Mm-hmm.
But in Cairo, whenever you are late, you have something to blame.
Really? Very interesting.
Yes.
So what brought you here this time around?
The World Bank meetings, mm-hmm, the IMF meetings.
Mm-hmm.
As usual, we come here twice a year, the spring meetings and these fall meetings.
Yes.
We come as observers, but it's a good place for us to meet so many of our stakeholders, the African ministers of finance, governors of central banks, as well as many banks, international and African, who we do business with. So it's very good for us.
Now, the last time I checked, I think there is only one country, and that is the United States of America, that happens to have veto power at the International Monetary Fund. Is that true?
Well, I wouldn't say there's anything called veto power there. But there is an implicit veto power, even in ordinary organizations, corporations. If you have the shares, you have the veto power.
Mm, mm. Do you agree with your fellow panelist, Joel, that Africa indeed benefits from being a member of that very, very important Bretton Woods institutions?
What you ask yourself is, what is the alternative? I think within the multilateral framework, I think there are good institutions to be part of. Some good have come out of them,
mm-hmm,
in some ways. But I think overall Africa has to take its destiny in its own hands. Africa should look at those institutions as enablers, but not as drivers of their development. So Africa must set their own targets and drive their own development, and then go to the World Bank to provide support to what they have decided to do. And also go to the IMF. So the IMF does what it was established to do.
Mm.
When you have temporary shocks, balance of payment shocks, current account shocks, the IMF steps in, but it should not be seen as a permanent panacea to your problem.
you should also try as much as possible to be in a situation where you do not have to go to the doctor called the IMF.
So what would be the other logical alternatives for Africa?
Well, we'll start doing something. The first thing is to break down the 84,000 kilometers of borders that divide us, which is actually at the root of the difficulties Africa faces today. It is because we are divided, we don't trade amongst ourselves, fragmented, that our economies are not able to rise above the levels we've seen today, despite almost six decades of independence. We have to make Africa to become a market, to move from being a basket case to becoming a breadbasket. With all the resources it has, the water, the land, the natural resources, and the people that it has, what has held us back is those divisions. So last year, the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement was signed. It was a very courageous move by the leaders. It is the first step, but it is a very, very important step because the political act has been done just to set the stage. But we had to move from that setting the stage, the political stage, to beginning to do things. That is why we must all, everybody, the business people, the banks, the government, the politicians, work together to make sure the AfCFTA works. In the new world order we are seeing today, where multilateralism appears to be in decline, unless we have a strong Africa, unless we have a strong voice together, we're not going to be able to engage in all the bilateral negotiations that appear now to become the way things are going to move. Sierra Leone cannot negotiate with the U.S., but if the whole Africa come and stands in front of the U.S. will take notice and we're likely going to get a better deal. So I think the AfCFTA is a very important move. If we make it work, we must then have started to take our destiny in our hands.
Of course, as you know, one of Africa's founding fathers, the Ghanaian Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, at one time said that seek ye the political kingdom, and the rest shall be added unto you. I know that you are not a politician. You are a professional, obviously running a Pan-African important economic institution, a bank. But what about the fact that Africa has pretty much remained the way a German man by the name Chancellor Bismarck in 1884 in Berlin decided to divide it for the benefit of Europeans and not Africans?
Well, I think it is important to use the lesson of history to define our vision for tomorrow. What happened in 1884, 1885 is very important. And I refer to it all the time myself, not to complain, but to make all of us and the younger ones know the origins of the problem we have. Because before the 1884-85 issues, Africa was in fact great. You know, the great Mansa Musa that was well known.
And
the map of old Mali.
Inflation in Cairo.
For 12 years, it depressed the prices of gold. And the old Mali was in the map in the 14th century. Timbuktu became a center of learning with big Arab scholars coming there. So Africa was a great continent. And trading amongst itself, doing business across. When the Europeans came, they couldn't actually break the kind of close-knit trading empire that had emerged in West Africa, If you go to East Africa the Kilwa, Tanzania, what present-day Tanzania, old Zimbabwe, all those kingdoms that were there, that which are strong. But the way to break them was to divide and rule. And you had those the events of 1884, 1885, which set the stage for what we have today. And I always refer people to what Abba Sarau, the one of the colonial administrators said in 1920 about colonialism. The main strategy was to make sure that the colonies never manufactured in the spot, made sure that the colonies never traded with their neighboring countries.
Right.
That the only thing that will happen will be with the colonial masters. You see it today in the way the infrastructure was built. You see it today the way the education was done. You see it today in the fact that I know more, because I'm originally a Nigerian, I know more about Britain than I know about somebody in Benin Republic just across the border. So,
or even about Nigeria actually itself.
Well, that is what it is. So for years, Africans had paid lip service to beginning to reverse this. It was only last year that this AfCFTA came about. Nobody ever knew it would happen. Mm. When we were in Kigali, about to go into the summit, the AU summit, where it was eventually signed, the even in the morning, the thinking was that only 21 countries would sign. But as it was opened for signature, behold, 44 countries signed. And before you know it, today everybody has signed. You have the last time I checked, just slightly under 30 ratifications. So this is marvelous. I think we're beginning to change what Bismarck did in 1884, 1885. Hmm. Better late than never. But there's a lot of work to be done. The political act has been done. I mean, Nkrumah is seeking the political kingdom. Yes, it's important to have that political support. That has happened. The next is that we must then all work together to make sure we realize the goals we all have set for ourselves for which our political leaders made those commitments when they signed the agreement for the free trade for Africa.
Very interesting. Joel, I think that the gentleman is right on the money. But is there really what you would characterize as the appropriate political will in order for this institution to end up, in fact, delivering goodies to the people of Africa?
I think for the first time, as Professor Rama has said, the political act has taken place. We've been talking about this for a very long time. Mm. And the mere fact that with the guidance of people like Professor Rama at the head of AFREX and helping, shaping, driving, pushing from behind, not everything is formal. Mm. Some of it is behind the scenes and formal working with leaders. For instance, you will have seen Nigeria did not want to sign. I think that is well known, you know.
South
Africa was at least went in, but Nigeria was very reluctant to sign. But eventually, President Buhari came to the table and realized that perhaps it will make sense to sign. It doesn't mean it's perfect, but as they say, don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. There are other things. It is the political will has been signed. There are other details, you know, to be done. The whole issue of the tariffs, the non-tariff barriers, have still got to be challenged. Because the tariffs are one thing, those are clear. It's the non-tariff barriers to trade that are not visible, that nobody can see. Those are the things that we will need to tackle. But unless Africa trades with itself, we will really remain far behind the rest of the world in terms of business, in terms of trade. You need to compare to places like Asia, the way it trades with itself, when Pakistan will trade with Malaysia and whatnot. We is a situation where Nigeria is not trading as much with the countries surrounding, as the professor has said. So it is something that we do need. It not only helps the exchequers of our countries, it also helps on things like jobs. It brings about development to our societies.
But is that really possible unless Africa gets the kind of courage to be able to remove these superficial, artificial borders that actually serve someone else's interests and not the African people?
I think the Chinese, I think it's the Chinese who say any journey starts with the first step.
Correct.
So we have started. It is a journey. I think the mistake is that sometimes people think that because the agreement has been signed, that is it.
It's about starting
and making it effective.
But and if we use that analogy, Joel.
Yes.
Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, in a sense, initiated the first step on March 6th, 1957.
Yes.
So where are we?
You know what, Shaka? At the end of the day, we have to learn from our mistakes. As the professor has just said, it has taken us 60 years.
Right.
But I don't think the next generation is going to be like us. You see?
I hope not.
They don't have the time. They need jobs.
Nor do they have the luxury.
Yeah. They need jobs. Right. We at least had food we could get from around. That is not the case for the next generation. So if you do not move on things like this, they will not be able to eat. And a hungry man is very difficult to keep them in control or in check. But so there is. So I believe that we're going to move.
But when you think about it, really, Africa is arguably the richest continent on this planet Earth. And yet, Africans are the poorest.
Yes.
How do we address this sort of unnecessary contradiction, really? Because last time I paid a courtesy call on Zambian founding president, Dr. David Kenneth Kaunda. I remember telling him that one of the reasons I admired him so much, and I was a graduate student at UCLA, one of the reasons I admired him so much with his close colleagues like Tanzanian founding president Mwalimu Julius Kambarage Nyerere, and of course the Ghanaian founding leader, the Osagyefo, was because they were able to demonstrate that for them, when it came to Africa, there were no borders, there were no boundaries.
Yes.
They did not only talk the talk about African unity. They, in fact, were able to walk that talk so that the Africans of that time were able to walk the walk. What happened?
Well, no, you are right. Things happened. We need to ask ourselves, what happened to Africa in the past 20 or 25 years, as different from what happened just about 50 to 60 years ago. There was a place where we were discussing this. You see, all of a sudden, Africa appeared to lose its direction.
Direction.
But it had a lot to do with the events of the 1980s. You may be surprised to know that prior to 1980, Africa was doing better than Asia. In terms of per capita income, Africa was better. In terms of reserves, foreign exchange reserves, Africa was better. In terms of export performance, Africa was better than Asia, including China. It was by 1985 that it changed. And what happened? We had the commodity price crash, something that originated in Latin America, the so-called MBA crisis. Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina went into a crisis, and it impacted the banks. So the banks cut credit lines. Africa was hit for it. And immediately, the continent went into a decline. And that's why the 1980s is called a lost decade. Now, it then compounded political problems. The Cold War was there. Africa was always the battleground for the Cold War. But when the economic crisis came, number of coups skyrocketed. You used to have, in the 1970s, coups and coup attempts of about 20-something. It rose to about 60-something per year. So it had this turbulence. And then the military took over, started taking over in many countries. And the economy decline set in. And because these people that took over were not the people who had the political vision of the Nkrumah, Nyerere, the Kaunda. They were there for themselves.
They were political adventurers.
They were there for themselves. It's like a friend of mine who was asking me, oh, this, there was a general in Nigeria who was there, and he was saying the man was not a good ruler, and so on and so forth. And I told him that you complaining should go and check yourself. When a man decides to go and do a coup, the person knew the consequence, it would be death. Assuming he decided to do a coup because he just felt he wanted to become a billionaire.
Well, that
and then he was willing to put his neck on the on the table for that.
Was that the man talking about the late General Sani Abacha?
Well, no, I don't want to mention names, but I said, but the president goes on and succeeds.
Ibrahim Badamasi Babangida.
No, I don't want to name anybody, but you were just talking about one of the leaders complaining, and I said, no, don't look at it that way, because when the military ruler takes over, decides to do a coup. If he was caught, would you tell him, please step aside, I will go and be executed rather than you?
Right.
No, you wouldn't do that. So he succeeds, and he starts to execute his own personal plan.
He's a patriotic.
Of becoming rich.
He's a patriotic.
And you are coming out to tell him that he's not really well. So the reason I'm telling this story is to say that, you know, the military regime, you would be lucky if you had a good one. Not that we didn't have some good ones, but it's just a matter of luck.
But some civilian rulers themselves have not done better either.
Now, those ones, you can take them to account voted for them.
But how do you do that, especially some of these ones, in fact, who seized the power through AK-47, but they are civilians?
Well, that's like military. anybody who took power by force overthrew a properly constituted government, is the same thing.
They have a sense of entitlement.
Yeah, there must be something.
And they are patriotic to their stomachs, the stomachs perhaps of their families.
Some may actually
and
be,
friends.
Some may be
not
actually,
society.
Some may be really patriotic, but that is a chance you take. That is, some people may decide that they don't like what's going on, and they don't find a way to get there. And then it's just a matter of luck. You don't want to leave that into chance. It's better for you to have a political system that makes your leaders accountable. So when they are there, you can complain that we are not doing what you said, what you promised us. But somebody who comes and takes over did not come to convince you about anything. So that's, I think, what happened to Africa.
Does not owe you.
It doesn't owe you anything. So that is what happened to Africa. But luckily, from the late 90s and all, the things started changing again. Political reforms. So we started having again a political process generating leaders that were voted in and becoming more accountable. And that is why you are beginning to see the changes we are seeing. Again, after decades of military rule, autocratic rule and all that,
dictatorship.
You will not expect that we will come over it overnight. So the new leaders are doing their best, in my view. Gradually, we will all come back to what was in the 1960s. The way where Africa was going before it was disrupted by that economic shock that we witnessed.
It's very interesting. Now, Joel, he alluded to what happened in Asia, for example. You know as well as I do that when you look at the successful city-state of Singapore,
yes,
under Lee Kuan Yew,
yeah,
for 31 years, the prime minister of that city-state was able to develop it from poverty, from a third world type of economy, to a first world.
Yeah.
When you travel around the world, you see these huge 747 Boeings, Air Singapore, and all sorts of things. When you think about China, which he also talked about, you and I grew up looking at a man called Chairman Mao Zedong. The average Chinese was riding a bicycle.
Yes.
There were no highways. The average Chinese, almost everybody, had one choice of cloth. But today, China is sitting on the second largest economy in the world. China is considered to be a factory of the world. And where does China get those minerals, for example, that makes it tick? They get those minerals, the last time I checked, from Africa. When you talk about copper, you talk about cobalt.
Yeah.
When you talk about oil, you're talking about Nigeria. You're talking about Angola. You're talking about all these things. What happened?
I think it's very simple. Professor talked about the fact that Africa lost its way.
Yes.
And that is the truth. We have to acknowledge Africa lost its way. When you talk about Singapore, a place I've spent quite a bit of time in, and Professor just arrived from Singapore.
Yes.
They had two things, vision and strategy and education. So
commitment.
Once you commit yourself to those two, you will uplift your people. We've seen that in China. We've seen that in many Asian countries. That has been the success story. They didn't have money. They didn't have the resources. Singapore doesn't have resources. It has no resources. And yet it is one of perhaps the richest individual country in the world. So it is about commitment, vision, and then having a plan to execute that. Well, that is what we have lacked in Africa. And until we have that, we will not even be making any sense of the free trade area that people like Professor Orama have been working, and his institution have been working very hard to ensure that it comes. They're to be commended for ensuring that at long last we've got there. But from there, that is the starting base. And unless we then say we are going to try and as much as possible articulate the what is within that agreement, work towards a plan of articulation and achieving, we are going to stay the same. Poor, irrelevant to world issues, and frankly, our people going nowhere.
Interesting. Professor, where is Africa's Dao Xiaoping, the man, for example, following Mao Zedong's death, the man who came on the stage and decided that he was going to use capitalism to develop socialism. He talked about how he did not, for example, care about the color of the skin of the cat all he cared about was whether the cat could in fact catch a mice.
Yes.
Where is our Dao Xiaoping?
Well, I think we're having them today. You know, the ceremony we witnessed at the signing, the signature of the AfCFTA, today we look at it, looks simple. But me and you know that just a few years ago, decades ago, it would have been unthinkable. It would have been unthinkable. Because everything we do in Africa, something like that, has broader geopolitical implications. And sometimes our leaders did not have the courage to do some of those things that were necessary, but that carried some risks. That is why what they did, we must see it as profound. It's not simple. And that is, we are beginning to go to, that's the pink story you're talking about. People have started now to say, look, we have to rise up to our calling. We can no longer be in a continent of potential that's never realized. Ever since I was a child, I went to school. They said, Africa is full of potential. Today they say Africa is potential.
You talk about that. I remember sincerely when I was in primary school, after the time I left Uganda, and that is about 43 years ago.
Is it potential?
All I used to hear was, for example, how Africa produces what it does not consume and consumes what it does not produce. And I have also heard some of the African leaders talking about adding value. And some of these leaders have been in power for 30 years. How do you add value? How can you possibly have power and justify actually being in charge of a nation of millions of people, and you are not, in fact, using power as a force of good for your people, to change the quality of life of your people? And you say you are a leader. You can't be a leader.
Yes.
Well, I'm, you know, in Studio 47, unfortunately, Professor, there is no democracy. If the producer says you have to go for a break, you have to go like a good soldier. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. I would like to thank Professor Benedict Oke Orama, President of the African Export Import Bank, for joining us. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them. Today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Welcome back, and now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, thousands have fled the eastern parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo following ethnic violence targeting the Banyamulenge community. We take a closer look at what's fueling violence in the DRC on the next Straight Talk Africa.
And today we are talking about trade in Africa. Our guests are Joel Okibazo with us here in the studio and is a former senior executive at the Africa Development Bank. Earlier we were joined by Benedict Oke Orama, president of the African Export-Import Bank. I have to say, Joel, for those who probably may not know you, that you've really done your part. You have been a distinguished public servant, whether domestic, regional, or international. The last time I checked, you were head of communications and a spokesman of the Commonwealth.
Yes, that's true.
At the Secretariat.
Yes.
Marlborough House in London.
Yes.
I also, of course, I remember the first time I ran into you, you were just like me. You belonged to my tribe.
I did.
You
I
were a journalist with Financial Times of London.
That's right.
And you also worked for the BBC.
That's right.
You've been around.
Yes.
So what do you do now?
It's age. We are now so old. No. Thank you very much for your kind words. And what I do now is that I run a consultancy out of London advising governments and corporates about Africa and how, in some cases, it is about trade and how they can engage with African governments and African enterprises. But sometimes it is also just about how to raise their profile within that continent and how best to do a business. Mm. We also do it the other way, whereby you take an African entity that feels that it wants to speak to the world. And I think that is one of the biggest changes that we are now seeing, that you now have people who are wanting to, who are moving out of their own borders and deciding that they need to go forward and speak to the world. So for me, that is what I'm trying to do and help and play my part, basing it very much on all the other things that I've done in the past.
Very interesting. I have to say, of course, again, that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa for the first time.
Yes.
Even though, in fact, we should have done before and probably many times because our paths have crossed a lot.
They have indeed. And I will sort of return the compliment if I may. I've been a great admirer. And of course, you're a pioneer. And of course, what people may not realize is your viewers out there that we are compatriots. And I think we've both served in our own ways and entities, served our motherland well, if I may say so, sir. And I think you've got many admirers and many people who feel you've blazed the trail. So I also feel it's important to mention that for those who don't know, to some of us who do and have the pleasure, it is an honor also to be here, and that is why I'm here.
Well, first of all, I have to say frankly, Joel, that the feeling is mutual. And I also have to say that I honestly thank you for both your compliments and support.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We have to keep up, you know, pushing the struggle.
That's right. There's other people coming up, young people.
Yes.
Who are going to take over from us.
Yes.
You see.
We should pass on the baton.
We have to pass on the baton. Yeah. And there are the foot soldiers.
Interesting.
Onto the next battlefield.
You're right. You're right. There's no question about it. You know, I realize, by the way, that the coming into being of this important bank, African Bank of Export and Import, that we were supposed to be really talking about with the president, the president, Professor Oke Orama, was in fact a brainchild, or at least it was an offshoot of what you, the institution that you actually worked for.
Yes.
In Tunisia, in Tunis, and in Abidjan.
In Abidjan.
The African Development Bank.
Very much so. And The African Development Bank has actually been really at the cutting edge of many initiatives in Africa. Mm-hmm. You know, there was that what's now called the Trade and Development Bank as well. So not only Afrexim, but also the Trade and Development Bank is very much a sort of, for want of a better term, a sort of, some would say baby, some would say it is helped into being.
Right.
By the African Development Bank. But the African Development Bank was founded in 1964.
And where is that headquartered?
It is the African Development Bank is Abidjan.
Yeah, Abidjan.
Trade Development Bank is headquartered technically in Burundi.
In Burundi.
Bujumbura, but actually operates mainly.
Is that what it used to be called? There was a certain bank that was based in Bujumbura.
Yes, now it used to be PTA Bank.
PTA, yes, Preferential Trade.
Trade Bank, that's right.
Okay, okay.
It is now very much operating out of Nairobi and Mr. Damasu Tadese.
Yes.
But it is a part of, so those kind of institutions that have been helped along the way, we also know now Africa 50, which is also another institution that has been, shall we, supported and helped along the way by the African Development Bank. It shows you that the African Development Bank is a catalyst.
It's a catalyst.
It's a leader, but it's also a catalyst for the whole development. So that, for instance, in the area of trade, hence the Afrexim Bank, and in many other things that are happening. So,
and would I say that these institutions that you mentioned actually do complement and supplement each other?
Absolutely. And even if you go to the African Development Bank's annual meeting, you will see these institutions. They do work together, and they very much complement the work that is being done by the African Development Bank itself. I think the founding fathers, you know, and that was our the independence generation who created the African Development Bank, looked to it to be a leader and a catalyst for development.
Correct.
And in encouraging these other institutions along, I think that is what it has been doing. But not only that, it also now works with so many other international bodies. The president of the bank, Dr. Adeshina, will be here in during these proceedings of the Bretton Woods institutions, and it's something that I have always been very involved in.
I have had him on the show, and he's a remarkably impressive individual.
Absolutely. So what I'm saying is that I think the bank is fulfilling its destiny, its ambition, and the targets that were set by the founding fathers in 1964.
As someone, frankly, who is an expert in communication, in public relations, and you name it. Any particular reason, for example, why the African Export and Import Bank is hardly known, really?
I think it's the main. A lot of these institutions, to be fair, even the African Development Bank, are just coming into the consciousness of the general public. I think there were institutions that maybe decided, or rather inadvertently, not deliberately, to concentrate on doing the job. But these days you can't just do the job, because also you need legitimacy, public legitimacy.
Correct.
So I think of late they have realized that actually for us to continue doing what we're doing, we need a public mandate.
You need to account to your people.
You need to be accountable.
Right.
It is not important. It is not enough to just say we are doing a good job.
Correct.
So that is why you find that now that increasingly the institutions such as these that never used to be known are increasingly putting their stall out to say, folks, this is what we are doing in your name. After all, they are owned by the populations of Africa. They're not
by
owned
the
by
the African taxpayer.
That's right. They're owned. Yes, they're supported by the international community, France, Germany, Japan, the United States, but they're owned and they're headquartered, and their raison d'etre is to look after the African population.
But are these institutions in fact owned by the Africans?
They're owned by the Africans. My view is that they're owned by the Africans, but supported by the international community. Because at the end of the day, even if you're getting support from outsiders, that money is going on building a road, a school or whatever sort of infrastructure development that is happening on your territory, in Rwanda, in Uganda, in Togo, it's going to do that. So to me, they are owned by us, supported by the international community.
But if that is true, you know, the last time I checked, it seems to me the single largest shareholder, you know, as far as the African development is concerned, is not an African nation.
I think it depends on the way you... No, I think there's some truth in what you're saying. By that, I think you mean the biggest contributor financially.
Right.
We are not by far the biggest contributors to the African Development Bank, nor even to the institution of the African Union, if one may say so.
As a matter of fact, when you talk about the African Union, its home,
yes,
is, can you believe, with love from Beijing. And you know...
But it is in Addis Ababa.
And you know English very well, in fact, even better than me. You know, there is a saying that whoever pays the piper calls or may call the tune.
Yes. And I think the president of Rwanda was leading an initiative about the financing of the African Union, assisted very much by my former boss, the Dr. Don Kaberuka, who was the head of the African Development Bank, a past president.
Mm-hmm.
So Africans themselves are starting to look at the ways in which they can finance their own institutions. We are still some way away. We're still a long way away. But in the meantime, we are going to take the support of those who are friends and partners and work on the behalf and for the people. Because it's only that that will then help transform us, and eventually we shall also be, shall we say, able to finance our own development.
Joel, let me ask you a question that I often ask to distinguished guests like you. What is it, if you could put your fingers on it, that you think has perhaps been the most important decision that you made in your public life? And what about the single most regrettable, if any?
The single most regrettable in public life?
Yes.
The most important one? Goodness me. I think what helped me into public life, I made a commitment. It was so easy not to commit my life to Africa.
Mm.
I could have gone and done a lot of other things.
Yeah.
But I decided that I must in some way, because of where I knew where I came from and the kind of conditions I saw as I was growing up as a child in Uganda, that made me decide that in some way I'll commit myself to Africa. So I think that's the most important. And it's been at the root of everything I have done.
You've never run away from your roots?
No, never run away. Even the citizenship is still Ugandan.
And that's the reason why I always say I'm a kid from Kabale. Well, on that note, our distinguished guests are Joel Kibazo, and earlier in the show we had Benedict Oke Olama. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.